Back to paper 15, section 7 tonight, which is old single column, page 174. Okay, we have a little bit of a combo mix here tonight with these two sections. Start with they give us this little thumbnail sketch of the architectural spheres, and then we'll get into a little bit of thinking about physics. Let's get rolling.
7. The architectural spheres. While each super universe government presides near the center of the evolutionary universes of its space segment, it occupies a world made to order and is peopled by accredited personalities. These headquarters worlds are architectural spheres, space bodies specifically constructed for their special purpose. While sharing the light of nearby suns, these spheres are independently lighted and heated. Each has a sun which gives forth light without heat, like the satellites of paradise. While each is supplied with heat by the circulation of certain energy currents near the surface of the sphere. These headquarters worlds belong to one of the greater systems situated near the astronomical center of their respective superuniverses.
Okay. Now, first of all, let's think about the astronomy, basic astronomy in there. You remember back when we were first sorting out what the relationship is between the Milky Way galaxy and the superuniverse of Orvinton, our segment of the superuniverse level, and the Milky Way galaxy right in the center of that segment. And at the center of the Milky Way galaxy is where Universe is, where the superuniverse headquarters is. So astronomically, when you know, the context of this paragraph, remember what we were looking at when we thought about looking towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy. You're looking towards that subgalactic system at the center of the disk, that central bulge, that quasi spherical, or spheroidal blob of stars that's at the center of the disk, thicker and then the disk, so it's called a bulge. So you've got that much denser region of stars, the center of the galaxy. So when they're talking about sharing the light of nearby suns, okay, you can easily be in a region, where there's a lot of stars in the vicinity. Okay, so you don't just have one close star like we do, the sun, and then the rest of them are way off as just little points in the night sky. You could, they don't give us any details, but you could have a number of stars that, are relatively close. Okay, and they say that Uversa, the headquarters, is part of some. We see one of the greater systems. So there's some, somewhere in that central bulge, they're saying there is some system of stars of which Eversa and the associated immediate facts are close to. Okay? So just kind of keep that in mind that. When astronomers are looking towards the center of the galaxy, they're certainly looking towards these systems that they're talking about here, these astronomic systems. Okay. They're not seeing Eversa directly. Okay, now, so that's the basic, relatively straightforward astronomy that's in play. You got a fairly dense region of stars, and they're part of that in some way. And then they throw in the not-so-normal phenomena. To start with, okay, unlike the other headquarters worlds and their satellites, you see, Eversa very much is going around a star, okay, and a special star. One of these stars that emit light without heat. Okay, just the same kind of luminosity that the sun's worlds around the aisle emits. Okay? Something we don't understand right now. So each of the headquarters of the seven super universes has this very special construct where you have one of these stars that emit light without heat, and then that the universe is orbiting that star. Yeah, so it has a sun. The universe has a sun. Okay, and then you're left to just wonder about, well, okay, so this star that emits light without heat, it apparently is part of this greater system in some way. You know, they don't give you any clues about what the structure is, you know, what's orbiting what or, you know, anything. But in some way, you've got a system of stars, and one of those stars is special, the star that emits light without heat, and the universe is orbiting that star. So that's the basic astronomic context. And it's in that direction in the sky that we call Sagittarius, yeah, down there in somewhere near the center of the Milky Way galaxy in the central bulge. Okay, so now let's get into the, you know, the fun stuff about the actual architectural worlds.
Time is standardized on the headquarters of the super universes. The standard day of the super universe of Orvantan is equal to almost 30 days of Urantia time, and the Orvantan year equals 100 standard days. This Uversa year is standard in the seventh super universe, and it is 22 minutes short of 3,000 days of Urantia time, about 8 1/5 of your years.
Okay, now, other than, you know, those of you who've been reading for years know that in various spots in the book, they give you these sort of standard time measuring systems that you have at the super universe level, at the local universe level, at this local system level. So, I mean, that's, you know, it has that, just that basic factual aspect where they're giving you some sense of how long, you know, a quote-unquote day is, you know, and now literally you have some world that's rotating once on its axis. So when they're saying day, they mean the day like we think of it, okay, the time it takes for a world to rotate once on its axis. And there are also, you know, because they're using the day and the year ideas, even a week, they throw in a week in this system is 10 of those whatever days. It's like the year is 100 of those days. So they're telling you that the way we break things up into days and weeks and years and how we kind of think about various projects or activities as being a day's work or a week's work. I mean, they have that same basic structure to how they go about their day-to-day business that we do. So that's, you know, that's an important bit to just recognize, that that structure that we have to time is coming down from above. That's why we have a tendency to think that way, because it's just the way the whole system that we're part of is set up. So now, besides that, there's some interesting little subtext to think about with this. Okay, so let's start with, do you remember when they tell you about the local system headquarters, and also it's the same with the constellation headquarters, any of the constellation headquarters. You have the headquarters world in both cases, and then there's some number of satellites around that headquarters world, and then there's sub-satellites around each of the satellites. Okay, so you have these three different, you know, sets of worlds, all architectural spheres, and they tell you at the constellation local system level that those sub-satellites are roughly the size of the Earth, yeah, in both cases. And then the primary satellites are roughly 10 times the diameter of the Earth. Okay, so in other words, they're about the size of Jupiter. Okay?
Jupiter's more than 10 times.
About 11 times the diameter of the Earth, Jupiter is. Okay, so about the diameter of the Earth, 10 times. I mean, about the diameter of Jupiter, excuse me, about 10 times the diameter of the Earth. Okay, so that's the satellites. So these satellites are pretty big objects. You remember, if it's 10 times the diameter, 10 times the radius, it's 10 times 10, it's 100 times the surface area. Okay. And then both, like in our case, both the Adensia and Gerasim, the headquarters worlds, are roughly 100 times the diameter of the Earth. Okay, in other words, they're about the size of the sun, of our sun. Okay. So which is roughly 100 times the diameter of the Earth. Okay, and if it's 100 times the diameter, it's 100 times the radius, it's 100 squared, it's what? Yeah. 10,000 times the surface area of the Earth. Okay? So in both of those cases, that's the structure you have. You say, well, why aren't the constellation ones bigger? Why do they still go to the 1, 10, 100 sequence? Shouldn't they be bigger? Because you have 100 local systems feeding into one constellation. Well, there's a lot greater number of architectural spheres at the constellation level. There's 771 at the constellation level, okay, and there's only 57 at the local system level. So as you can see, you've got you have an increase in surface area to work with, okay, just by increasing the number of objects in play without actually increasing the sizes. But you do get the sense that above the constellation level, things start getting bigger, okay, than that sort of 1, 10, 100 pattern. They don't tell you, but you get the definite sense. And just thinking about it, it's going to have to start getting bigger because you don't have more and more numbers, okay? So you know they're going to be even bigger. Well, how big? Well, indirectly, they're giving you a little clue about this. When they tell you about Gerasim, okay, you say, well, okay, so Gerasim is the size of the sun, basically, okay? And they tell you that that world rotates once on its axis in what we call 3 days. That's moving. The sun takes like 25 or a little more than 25. Okay? 3 days. That great big sun-sized object spins. Okay? It's got a lot more centrifugal acceleration than on the Earth. Okay? So in other words, see, they're giving you, you're giving you a little clue here. They're saying, well, when we make these architectural worlds, it's okay to have them rotating, significantly faster. Say 10 times faster than the Earth in terms of how much centrifugal force. You have about 10 times the centrifugal force that you do on the Earth. The way that works is if the period of the rotation is 3 times greater, the centrifugal force goes as 1 over the square of that period, rotation period. So 3 times 3 is 9, so there's 1 over 9. But the diameter, or the radius, okay, they said it's almost 100 times bigger. So let's say it's 90. So 90 divided by 9 is 10. See, it has 10 times the centrifugal force of the Earth. So if you just say, okay, maybe they're giving me kind of a rule of thumb. I mean, let's just assume that that's kind of the way they're going to do the architectural worlds in general, that that's the kind of rotation rate relative to the radius that they're going to give them. I mean, that the transport seraphim are going to all these different worlds. It's bound to be, some sort of standardization of some of these things to some degree. So let's just kind of run with that assumption. you know, you'd probably assume, see, that the constellation worlds are in about the same mode as, again, as this with the rotation rate as the local system. But they tell you that when you go up to the local universe level, and they talk about Salvington, they say that Salvington, the time it takes Salvington to rotate once on its axis, is 18 and a quarter days. Okay? See, so, that's getting, you know, it's getting to be quite a bit bigger number. So, yeah, it's pretty likely, you know, that this thing is going to be quite a bit bigger. Okay? And then you get up to Eversa. Okay, and what did they just tell you? It's about 30 days that it takes for it to rotate once on its axis. Okay, so now we got something that's about the same, you know, as our sun. You know, the time it takes our sun to rotate once on its axis. Okay, it takes 30 days for Eversa to rotate once. So if you had the similar centrifugal force, okay, 30 times 30 is 900. You're going to need 9,000 times the radius of the Earth. Okay, 9,000 times the radius of the Earth is a sphere that has the diameter of the orbit of Mercury. Right. 9,000, you know, that's almost exactly what Mercury's, you know, the radius of Mercury's orbit is, or diameter. Okay, it's 9,000. So it's, you've got a sphere, a solid sphere. That would be your first estimate of how big Eversa is. Okay, a sphere. It's 9,000 times the diameter of the Earth, about the size of the orbit of Mercury. Okay, and you know, do like they did and kind of just round it to the nearest power of 10. So it's like 10,000 times the diameter, 10,000 times the radius. How much bigger is the surface area? 10 to the 4th squared. Okay. What is that? 100 million times the surface area of the Earth. Okay. 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 8th. 100 million. 100 million times the surface area. That's how big a solid object, a solid world, a ball of gas, okay? You know, it's a world that you can walk on that has a surface area that's 100 million times the surface area of the Earth.
Now, they're not using that velocity to offset the gravity on that surface.
No, partly. Could be.
I guess it would, but it wouldn't be the same at the pole.
Sure, right. See, yeah, you start to bring in all kinds of thoughts here, see, you know. Yeah. I mean, you start to wonder about, is there some order about who's near the equator and who's near the pole, depending on what kind of being you are, you know. Okay, so you can start to kind of speculate on some things.
I was reading about the triangles and the squares and the circles, and they said that the promenade was 500 miles. No, it was 5,000 miles. And so I just, I always speculate as to just how big the beings that...
Right, just think about that. You just keep that in mind when you're reading about what's on the surface of Jerusalem. You know, you can put a structure, you know, a building that has the diameter of the Earth,
right?
Okay, on the surface of Jerusalem, and it's just a little spot. Okay? And they do. They build structures like that. Okay?
My question is, relative to the size of the beings that live there, then you have to assume that if you're going to walk into it, you would feel like one of those cartoons. You're this big, and the house you're in.
Right, but see, I mean, they may have stadiums that are huge, okay? But the buildings are you know, human size and stuff. I mean, you know, Adam and Eve are not 5,000 feet tall. Okay, you know.
Yeah, you're right. No, but right? How do you visit a place that's 5,000
right.
miles?
Yeah, and
how do you go visit?
Okay, let me just have one little sidetrack on that to keep in mind. Remember, more and more after this life, remember when we talked about the senses. More and more, you appreciate that your senses are really mindful. Not so much physical. We have this bias here. But you can even remind yourself here. I mean, I'm not seeing with my eyes, actually. I'm seeing with my mind. Okay? My mind is interpreting some various, you know, physical phenomena, okay, related to my eyeballs and optic nerves and whatnot. Okay? more and more you're going to recognize your senses are mindal, okay? And more you have a more extended presence of mind, okay? So more and more, you know, if I want to see something very far away or I want to feel like I'm close to the vast extent of some huge structure. See, my mind is kind of present in that whole huge structure. I can see it as if I'm really all over in that massive structure. So you can just kind of think about you're going up in kind of a funnel of mind as you know, the higher you ascend. And you know, and so your mind presence that you have a firm, stable grip on is spreading horizontally. And see, so more and more some vast structure won't seem so vast. In the same way, we build rooms right now, by and large, so that our consciousness doesn't feel like it's lost in it. Right. Yeah? See, so when your consciousness is a lot vaster there, mm-hmm. you can build a lot bigger room and you won't feel lost. You won't feel like this tiny little ant in some gigantic. And just think of it in, you know, not just in quality, but quantity. Okay. All right. So that would be my first, you know, back of the envelope guess. That's probably how big these super universe headquarters worlds are. Really huge. And they're zooming for something that big.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'm trying to remember. I think
30 days
for Mercury. Does Mercury take like 88 days or something like that? I think, if I remember right, to go around. See, you know, this is only 30 days. These things are zooming.
Yeah.
You know, they're all rotating pretty fast. You know, from what we're used to, the size. Yeah. All right.
What you brought up, people size.
But just see, that's the kind of, you know, they want you to start, you know, running with some of these things. They're not just giving these details to give you facts. There may be some need for giving you some facts so that you have some anchor points. But always be looking to do something with the facts they give you. Try to, you know, put the pieces together and get, you know, flow with it a little bit. Follow the truth a little bit. And to help you appreciate more of the spirit, quote unquote, of what they're talking about, you know, so your eyes don't just glare. It's like, okay, I would think that after we've talked about this, you have a little bit less of an abstract notion about what we're talking about. You know, is it going to be grand? Can you imagine as you're approaching these, you know, and that's just the, you know, the central. The headquarters world, I mean, it's got all these satellites and sub-satellites, too. They're going to be gigantic. I mean, it's just going to be so immense and so incredibly grand. And, of course, that 100 million times the surface area, every square inch of it is glory. Okay? So just, you know, just imagine how supernal an experience is going to be, you know, when you get there. They have the quantity and the quality. Okay. They have what your material consciousness is looking for and what your spiritual consciousness is looking for. Just because you've ascended all the way to universe doesn't mean you don't have material consciousness. You'll always have material consciousness because you're taking your material consciousness, your individuality consciousness, and your spiritual consciousness, your unity consciousness, always, and weaving the two together into a cosmic consciousness. That's what you see with. You know, more and more as you go up, in order to see, you can only see with the part of you that's the two woven together in perfect harmony. Less and less will you see with just the spirit or just the, you know, individuality eye. In order to really see what's to be seen, you need to have this 3D cosmic vision. That's why, because we have none of that in any absolute sense right now, that's why if they took you to the Isle of Paradise, you'd experience nothing. Okay? Doesn't matter how spiritual you think you are. You need 3D, you need cosmic vision to see anything there. You can't just see with a spirit eye, no matter how much you want to. Okay.
You can't be allowing that kind of gravity differential from the pole.
Now they're going to utilize all of it.
Right, so,
I mean,
you know.
That difference will be crazy.
Right. The other thing that they, you know, you got to remember, you've got, you know, all the power beings.
Right, they're equal.
You know, they're, yeah. So they wouldn't just let the centrifugal force and the gravity do, you know, okay. They're going to be playing with this too, but still. But just, you know, to appreciate the physical, just the raw physical foundation unmodified by power beings. That's what we're talking about. Okay.
The headquarters worlds of the seven super-universes partake of the nature and grandeur of paradise, their central pattern of perfection. In reality, all headquarters worlds are paradisiacal. They are indeed heavenly abodes, and they increase in material size, Marantia beauty, and spirit glory from Gerasim to the Central Isle. And all the satellites of these headquarters worlds are also architectural spheres.
Just the one little thing, I mean, reminding you going in for it. So remember what they're talking about, how it's only because of all the special circumstances of dark gravity bodies and all this sort of stuff that you can build worlds as large as the Havona worlds. See, so now you okay, how big are they? They're going to be real, you know, they're going to dwarf Uversa, right? They're just colossal spheres. And there's a billion of them. And there's a billion of them. And you got to visit them all. I mean, just think of the surface area that's involved there. Okay? You're getting lots and lots and lots of zeros now, times the size of the Earth.
The various headquarters worlds are provided with every phase of material and spiritual creation. All kinds of material, morontial, and spiritual beings are at home on these rendezvous worlds of the universes. As mortal creatures ascend the universe, passing from the material to the spiritual realms, they never lose their appreciation for and enjoyment of their former levels of existence.
See, and that was kind of, you know, sort of saying that, you know, and just make, you know, they're just stressing it even more literally. Even when you're all the way to Uversa and you think, wow, I'm on the doorstep of being a really full-blown spirit being of some sort, you know, you still can engage the matter. After all, you have to stand on something, if nothing else. Okay? You know, one of the fun things there, just like in Havona, we noticed kind of an interesting thing that you don't sort of, you know, remember initially when you're reading the Revelation. You get fairly early on that the local universe domain is very much a morontial domain. You know, you're ascending as a morontial being, a morontial being, you know, it's very much a morontial domain. But then, you know, you notice things, oh, but there's still morontia on Uversa. There's still morontia substance in Havona. Okay, so there's this hybrid substance being expressed at higher and higher levels too, and probably you know, even less understandable to us. I think it's probably that basic notion of it really really thinking in kind of some physical energy, spiritual energy we've woven together, that probably gets you some rough sense of Marantia at the local universe level. But you know, especially in Havona, it's going to be something very, you know, transcendent and not immediately understandable to us. But still, you know, it's going to be some sort of an intermediate construct. Okay? No matter how complicated intermediate is anymore. Okay? So that's that, and just, you know, to even coming back out as a finaliter, you still have this relationship to the material. Okay? You know, start right now. You know, stop letting your spiritual consciousness you know, think of matter as something to be shunned, you know, rejected, eventually left behind. No, discover the value of matter and combine it with the value of spirit substance and see what you can, you know, begin to develop in your mind.
Gerasim, the headquarters of your local system of Satania, has its seven worlds of transition culture. each of which is encircled by seven satellites, among which are the seven mansion worlds of Maranscha Detention, man's first post-mortal residence. As the term heaven has been used on Urantia, it has sometimes meant these seven mansion worlds, the first mansion world being denominated the first heaven, and so on to the seventh.
Before I just a quick comment on that, I forgot to just remind you. You did notice that every phase of material and spiritual creation, again, reminding you, don't just think of spirit substance as something that you make beings' bodies out of. Make buildings out of it and stuff too, okay? It's a substance. Okay, now, just one little thing in passing there. Well, I guess two things. Remember, you've got the local systems, headquarters worlds, have seven satellites, and each of the satellites has seven sub-satellites, and that's the general pattern. So you have 8 times 7 is 56, plus the center is 57 altogether, architectural worlds at every local system. And like they're mentioning, one of the notions that we've gotten through various vague visions and whatnot is that there's seven levels of heaven. And one of the facts that notion is tied to is the seven mansion worlds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 heavens. But there's also a greater notion that people have picked up on in various ways over the centuries. Another notion of a heaven of heavens, where the seven mansion worlds is heaven number one, Gerasim is heaven number two, Edentia and all its satellites is number three, Salvington and all of its satellites is number four, Uversa and its satellites is number five, Havona is number six, and Paradise is number seven. So there's that greater hierarchy of heaven of heavens that people have had vague notions of through visions. And obviously there's all of the revelations that have fed some things in too over the hundreds of years.
I'm certainly not a student of the Quran, but I know the Quran talks about seventh heaven,
yeah,
which I found interesting. What do you think that they're referring to? It couldn't be terribly sophisticated.
It's probably the seven mansion worlds.
Yeah.
Caught up to the third heaven, and these sorts of things. I mean, if you go, they talk about this in the section right before Maranscha Moda, up there in paper 48, you can look that up, and they point out that, most of the time when there's multiple heavens in someone's cosmology, it's because of they've gotten some sense of the seven mansion worlds. Yeah.
Did Melchizedek make much reference to the Kenites regarding this different?
He definitely would have made an effort to get them to more solidly understand up to the constellation level. Remember that's, Adam and Eve are supposed to be revealing up to the constellation level, the Most High. I'm priest of the Most High. That whole choice of names that he had for himself. So he would have tried to really help them to appreciate some of the details of the local system level and the constellation level, but not beyond that. At least that would be my guess. I shouldn't say it too definitively, but most likely he wouldn't have gone cosmologically any higher. He might have tried to give them a little bit higher sense of God and the distinction between God and the Most Highs and some things like that.
You're still worried about volcanoes, it'd be much too much.
Yeah, but that's, remember the Kenites, were ready to leave, Yahweh behind, okay? It's the Abraham, ministry that Melchizedek was fostering, that's just meeting the people where they were, which is struggling along post-rebellion and, with not anything too solid. You know, but the Trinity and those more definitive things, that's Melchizedek is teaching the Kenites. All right.
Edentia, the headquarters of your constellation of Nurlachadek, has its 70 satellites of socializing culture and training on which ascenders sojourn upon the completion of the Gerasim regime of personality, mobilization, unification, and realization.
So just the factual thing. So you have the headquarters world, 70 satellites, and around each of those satellites, which are in a string of pearls. Remember, all these things are done in string of pearls fashion, modeled after Havona. Okay. So it's not like you know, if you have the seven satellites of Gerasim, that they're strung out, you know, farther and farther away. They're in a string of pearls in, you know, one orbit around Gerasim. Same thing here. You've got 70 primaries in a string of pearls around Edentia. And then in a little sub-string of pearls around each satellite, you have 10 sub-satellites. So there's 771 total architectural spheres. Okay, let's get Salvington.
Salvington, the capital of Nebadon, your local universe, is surrounded by 10 university clusters of 49 spheres each. Hieron is man spiritualized following his constellation socialization.
Okay, so again, let's just get the facts. So the way this works is you go from the local system of the constellation to the local universe headquarters, you have seven satellites, and then you have 70, and then 70 again. So the top two each have 70. The bottom one has seven. And then the thing that varies is how many sub-satellites. But you have that simple pattern with the satellites, 7, 70, 70. Okay. Now the way it works, see, around Salvington, okay, so you have these 70 primary satellites in a string of pearls. Okay, and that string of pearls is divided into how many segments? 10. See, 10 university clusters. That means, so you take so you have an arc.
1/7.
See, there's 10, well, no, 1/10.
Sorry.
Yeah. I know it's tricky, and it'll be even worse when we get to Uversa. all right, so you have 10 groups. So there's seven in each group. Seven, you know, you have the seven Melchizedek worlds, you know, in a string, you know, a little choo-choo train going around Salvington. Okay, and then you have these 10 strings of seven, you know, to get 70 all the way around. Okay, now notice they don't tell you how many sub-satellites are around each one. They give it indirectly. So you have one of these groups of seven satellites, and it says in that segment there's 49 total. In other words, I have to have 7 times 7. Okay, so there's 6 sub-satellites around each primary one. See? So that you have 7 sevens. Okay? So that's the way the local universes are set up. 6 sub-satellites around each of 70 primary satellites. And then the central world. So how many altogether? No.
10 times 40.
Yeah. Plus the one in the center. So you have 49 in each. There's 10 of them. So there's 490 plus the center. 491. So you have 57, 771, and 491. You know, and then, of course, you got to spread that all the way around the Milky Way. You know, every local universe has 491. Every constellation has 771. You know, all billion local systems, well, or 7 billion if you take all 7 super universes, 7 billion local systems, each of those has 57. That's starting to get to be a big number when you add all those together. Okay. Okay, so then we go up. Oh, wait, now the other part. That's the numbers. Notice what they point out here, okay? Like we just were saying, you have this Merontial ascension or segment of your ascension career. in the local universe. And it has three stages, three levels to it. Local system, constellation, headquarters. You're going from individuality to associativity to unity in the Maronchal sense. See, so at the, like they say, at the local system level, for us on Gerasim, that's where you, the completion of the Gerasim regime of personality mobilization, unification, and realization. You leave Gerasim fully individuated as a Marantia being. Okay? And to do that, you have to get some significant personality actually in play to take a hold of that Marantia substance, definitively bring it to a focus, definitively individuate it, make you a Marantia individual. So that's what your first thing you're trying to do is to really take a hold of what the Father gave you as a potential. That potential to become a definitive, personalized, individualized being that can start the ascension career seriously. Okay? And then now that you're a definitive individual, and so is everyone else that's leaving the local system headquarters, you go to the constellation. Individuals now, definitive individuals, you can work on the associative aspect of that, the socialization. Yeah, until you're individuated, you can't really socialize. You overlay a whole bunch of fuzzballs, okay? But in order to get a true relationship, the first thing you have to do is truly individuate. Okay? You have to get yourself separate. So how important is your relationship to individuality consciousness? It's step one. You're not going anywhere if you're trying to reject your relationship to individuality, to matter, if you're trying to be just a pure unity phenomenon, okay, it's going to be a long trip to get to Gerasim, okay? You have to individuate first. Then you socialize. So individuality, associativity, and then finally, in the Marantial sense, you get to the local universe headquarters, and that's the spiritualization. Let's see, where in heck, I lost it. Okay, here. Hereon is man spiritualized, okay, following his constellation socialization. Okay, so that's individuality, associativity, unity. Just like this, individuality, associativity, unity. Okay, being ever more brought into a harmony by personality. Okay. Local system, constellation, local universe headquarters, all brought into a unity by personality, into a tri-unity, see? A tri-unity of individuality, associativity, unity. Okay. All right.
We feel we're individuals now. In what way it's like we're individuals?
You're an individualized blob of protoplasm, but not for very long. You're going to die soon. All of us are going to die soon. We're not going to have that gift, that free gift of individuation. See, we're given some individuation by grace, because, how else are we going to? God has to give us a little bit of localization, okay? But you're going to lose that. Okay, if you're going to be individuated in that Marantia body, which is more of like a liquid than a solid, you need to hold yourself localized.
Problematic, I think, was the
term. You'll just spread to the four corners of the universe until you're, totally rarefied to nothing. Okay.
But for the containment that they use for you,
that's getting to Gerasim. You have to choose to be individuated. You're not just held together by grace. It's to be chosen. Okay? Nothing is real unless it's chosen. You have to use your personality. See, personality mobilization.
It's all there.
All right. And now, Now we go, so we'd leave the local universe, we leave that very definitively moronchal segment behind, and we go into this transcendent segment. Then what?
U minor the third. Is that how you want to say that, U minor?
Mm-hmm.
The headquarters of your minor sector, ENSA, is surrounded by the seven spheres of the higher physical studies of the ascendant life. U major the fifth, the headquarters of your major sector, Splendon, is surrounded by the 70 spheres of the advancing intellectual training of the super universe.
Okay, now the numbers here, I guess we have to assume that you don't have sub-satellites in these two cases. They don't, unless I've missed it somewhere, I think we just have seven and then 70. So you see, that pattern still holds. But apparently you don't have sub-satellites. Now, one of the things that quote-unquote makes up for that to a degree, when you get to the major sector level, remember you don't just go to your major sector headquarters. So you don't just go to these 71 spheres. You have to go to all 10 major sectors.
Right.
So 71 times 10. Okay. You have 710 all the way around. Remember when we were talking about the numbers a little bit. You know, 10 is the individuality number. 7 is the unity number. You have a sevenfold differentiation of unity and a tenfold differentiation of individuality. No. So the relationship between that unity and that individuality, you know, that what we think of as the mindal domain, is going to have a 70-fold character. Seven things connected to 10 things. You can do it 70 different ways. Okay? So how many major sectors are there in the whole grand universe? 10 in ours times 70. There's 70. One for each flavor of basic mindal associativity. Okay? We have 10 in our super universe. We know nothing and won't for a long time about the other 60. Okay? different basic ways that you can associate individuality and unity on this more objective, literal level. And see, that's what they point out. See, the pattern was individualized associativity unity. The minor sector is about physical studies. The major sector is about intellectual training. So you know, well, it's a super universe headquarters. That's going to be, if it's physical, intellectual, it's spiritual again. See, it's individuality, associativity, unity. Only that threefold pattern in it, in sort of the full, more direct way, not the qualified, moronticized scaffolding way of engaging the threefold actuality, but now you're going to engage it in a much more direct fashion. You don't need an intermediary to help you. You can take it on in its raw form, and you do. Now we're going to really ground ourselves in the full-blown individuality and then associativity and then finally the unity that will get us into Havona, the unity foundation that's the key to getting into Havona, that new floor like we talked about, because then you flip and it's reciprocated. You start with that full-blown completed unity and you go up through a now transcendent associativity to an even more transcendent individuality. Okay. Let's see. Actually, let's just mention it here, because it's so obvious with these two, this curious coinage. I mean, you have the word minor and the word major, and they stick the letter U in front of it. Okay, we've talked about this before. Let's just remind ourselves. Why have they just used the letter U as part of a name? Okay. Because it's the 21st letter of the alphabet. Okay, it's 7 times 3. We're the 7th super universe. were the seventh expression of triune pattern. Seventh of triune, 7 times 3 is 21. Okay? See, so that's the way they've chosen to use that letter, nomenclature to designate. And then we have U-versa next. Let me just presage that. Again, it's the letter U, and then the word versa, which is Latin for hub. It's the hub of the U domain. It's the hub of the seventh expression of triune pattern.
How did you figure this?
Lots of reflecting.
What about our translations that we're doing? How will any of this have any relevance in Arabic?
So you're going to have to, in the extent to which you don't recognize this, you're going to, distort the translations.
That's what I mean. So this revelation really is meant to be read in English.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, that's where you find the foundation of the revelation, right? If you want to get serious about the fifth epical revelation, you have to find English and you have to find a relationship to it in English. Then you can, work from there. But if you're not doing that, you need to recognize you have a very fuzzy intermediary in between you and the revelation. Much fuzzier than the Maranchal, thing I was just talking about.
Because all these translations that we're doing could become very problematic.
They need someone to shepherd them, someone who has a solid relationship to the revelation in English. I mean, if the revelators had to get a solid relationship to English in order to be put on the commission. I mean, we need to do the same thing too. I mean, it doesn't matter if you were born speaking English. Everyone I think has recognized that, I'll be the first to admit, I didn't even remotely have a solid enough relationship to the English language to engage this revelation. Okay? I've had to teach myself a solid enough relationship to the truth of the English language in order to engage the truth of the revelation. What I learned in school was wholly inadequate to the task. Okay? You need to know English, not just be able to babble. Okay? Yes, it teaches English at the same time. Because the only way to get to it, is through English. The English is the interface between the human and the revelator. They came down, you go up. They expressed in the lowest English they could. You reach up to the highest English you can reach, and you'll meet in the middle. Just like you reaching up to the adjuster, and the adjuster reaching down, and you meet in the middle. Okay, so A, B, C, versa, for the first super universe. D, E, F, versa, for the second super universe, etc. Just go around to U, versa, for the seventh. Okay.
Uversa, the headquarters of Orvantan, your super universe, is immediately surrounded by the 7 higher universities of advanced spiritual training for ascending will creatures. Each of these 7 clusters of wonder spheres consists of 70 specialized worlds containing thousands upon thousands of replete institutions and organizations devoted to universe training and spirit culture, wherein the pilgrims of time are re-educated and re-examined preparatory to their long flight to Havona. The arriving pilgrims of time are always received on these associated worlds, but the departing graduates are always dispatched for Havona direct from the shores of Uversa.
Okay, so let's just get the numbers. And notice how it's similar but not the same as the local universe. So the super universe and the local universe headquarters have a parallel construct. You got a central world, and you have 70 primary satellites. Okay, but notice the difference. In the At the local universe, it was broken up into 10 groups of 7. Here, it's broken up into what? 7 groups of 10. Okay? So, there's 7 groups, see the spirit number, at the higher level. There's 10 groups at the lower, the individuality. See, notice the hierarchy. Okay, so if you have 7 groups, there's 10 in each group. Okay, now what are they saying? Okay, you have each of these 7 clusters of wonder spheres consists of 70 specialized worlds. Okay, so in each group, there's 70. How do you get that? If you have 10 primaries to get 70 total. See, so it's 7 times 10 is 70. Right. Again, you have 6 sub-satellites. So the basic structure is the same. 70 primaries, each with 6 sub-satellites. The difference is whether it's broken up into strings of 7 or strings of 10. Okay, that's the difference between Eversa and Salvington. All right. So they both have 4.
Every one of those?
Yep. Yeah. So they both have 491. Well, some things are off limits, and you know there is those issues. But by and large, yes. You know, it's the whole big Melchizedek University. You know, at the local universe level, and you know you got to go to the whole university. So yeah, you flesh out most of these worlds. And then just one other little thing. So that's the numbers part. Now that basic individuality, associativity, unity. And we said we got to a measure of unity at the local universe headquarters. Here we're doing it again. You're re-educated and re-examined. See, you're doing the spirit again. You're doing the unity again at a transcendent level. And it's basically your spiritual finishing school. Okay? You can now finish that basic unity foundation that allows you to get into Havana. All right.
Eversa is the spiritual and administrative headquarters for approximately 1 trillion inhabited or inhabitable worlds. The glory, grandeur, and perfection of the Orvantan capital surpass any of the wonders of the time-space creations.
Way back earlier in the paper, remember how they had the list of, okay, approximately 1,000 worlds in a local system, and then they, you know, went up the hierarchy. And we were saying, well, you know, does the approximately stay all the way up to the super universe? So that's just approximately a trillion? Or does it finally become exactly a trillion there? Now, what does it say? Approximately 1 trillion. See? So the approximately goes all the way through that list. You're going to have only approximately 1 trillion in each of the 7. Okay? But we know, like I've mentioned, when all is said and done with the whole grand universe, you have exactly 7 trillion sort of spots on paradise. Okay? That need to be filled. So how does that work? This is the last little paragraph.
If all the projected local universes and their component parts were established, there would be slightly less than 500 billion architectural worlds in the 7 super universes.
Okay, so here's where they're, you know, asking you to think about the things exactly and to notice how carefully they've always been kind of blurring the words, fudging the words a little bit. You know, they want you to initially just, you know, okay, I've got 1,000, you know, and I mean just think about it simply. But to get into the precision, you have to combine all of the evolutional worlds with the architectural worlds. When all is said and done, that whole group of worlds, because when all the evolutionary worlds are fully on 7th stage light and life, I mean, they're, you know, basically architectural worlds at that point. They've been, right. See, it all becomes a single set of worlds of exactly 7 trillion total. Okay. And so now when we're thinking about the numbers of the architectural worlds, obviously most of that, how do they say that again? Slightly less than 500 billion. Most of that is going to be all of the architectural worlds in the local systems. I've got 57 of them, okay, in each local system, and I have 7 billion local systems. That's 399 billion right there. Okay? And you throw in the constellations, there's 70 million constellations, and there's 771 in each one. Okay, you can basically ignore the rest, okay? I mean, the rest is negligible compared to the number that you get with just adding up all the constellation and local system ones. You've got about 453 billion. Okay? Less than 500 billion. Okay? And see, and that works, too, because if you then think about how many non-architectural ones, it rounds up to 7 trillion. See, so in one significant digit, you know, just rounding it to the nearest trillion, you know, like they all usually do, yeah, it's 7 trillion. But if you want to be very precise, it's, you know, it's a bit less, but not enough less that it doesn't still round to 7 trillion. See? That's the little game that they're playing. And they want you to eventually get to the point where, you know, wait a minute, you know, how does that, you know, and you can finally put that together, you know, and notice that they gave you that clue when they were talking about peripheral paradise, and they said there was exactly 7 trillion little reserves. I was like, huh, yeah. See, the numbers all add up. That's the way you get 7 trillion. Add up all the evolutionary with and combine it with the architecturals, and you have exactly 7 trillion in the grand universe when all is said and done. Okay? You know, I mean, if you add in the, you know, 491 at each local universe headquarters and 700,000 local universes, see, that's only, you know, if you keep it in billions, I mean, that's only 0.3437. I mean, you know, 0.3 billion. I mean, you know, it's negligible compared to, you know, it's in the noise. I mean, by and large, it's all the constellations and local systems give you most of that. Yeah, it's, what did I say, 453 billion. Ready? Yep.
8, energy, control, and regulation. The headquarters spheres of the super universes are so constructed that they are able to function as efficient power energy regulators for their various sectors, serving as focal points for the directionalization of energy to their component local universes. They exert a powerful influence over the balance and control of the physical energy circulating through organized space.
Not too surprising if it's as big as the orbit of Mercury, okay, that it could take on a pretty grand task or, you know, a role like they're describing there.
Further regulative functions are performed by the super universe power centers and physical controllers, living and semi-living intelligent entities constituted for this express purpose. These power centers and controllers are difficult of understanding. The lower orders are not volitional. They do not possess will. They do not choose. Their functions are very intelligent, but apparently automatic and inherent in their highly specialized organization. The power centers and physical controllers of the super universes assume direction and partial control of the 30 energy systems which comprise the gravita domain. The physical energy circuits administered by the power centers of Uversa require a little over 968 million years to complete the encirclement of the super universe.
Okay, just a couple things. Remember, you know, use this opportunity to stress in your mind again the difference between choice and decision. Yeah. So when you're talking about the power beings that aren't personalities, okay, they can't exercise will. are volitional beings. Okay, they can't make choices, but they can definitely make decisions. They're mindful. Okay? They're very intelligent. Okay, very high-minded. Okay, so they make endless. I mean, we can't even imagine how many decisions they make every nanosecond, I'm sure. Okay? They make lots and lots of decisions, but they don't make choices. You know, and it's very important for you to, you know, work on that distinction in your own mind, because we blur those two words together. We've talked about this a lot over the years. Okay? Mindful decisions, spiritual choices. Okay? For us, you're working top down. You make a spiritual choice, which is independent, you know, very fundamentally independent of time, independent of the specifics, okay? And then you bring that down into mindful decisions. You know, one choice spawns many, many decisions that are dealing with the specifics, because the mindful domain is associative, taking the unity, the choice, down into relationship to the facts, okay? And for different facts, you have a different association, a different translation of an ideal into an idea. Okay, choice, is just completely independent of the specifics. Okay, like I say so many times, that great line from the Bible: "Choose this day whom you will serve." It's not decide this day whom you'll serve. Choose, okay, this day whom you'll serve. You're making a choice. It has nothing to do, and it's never going to have anything to do with specifics. It doesn't matter if you're being burned alive or laying on a beautiful beach in the Bahamas. The choice is constant. And then one other little detail about the power beings. There's 10, like we've said a couple times tonight, there's 10 basic forms. But there's three phases of each of those, so there's 30 total. That's what they're alluding to there. I mean, the three for each of the 10 is because it's a three-dimensional reality. Okay, there's three different ways that each of the 10 can express. Okay, and let's just leave it at that. We don't need to go into any greater detail on that. But that's what the 30 is about. And you know, it's the gravita or gravita or however you want to say that. In other words, taking everything to the power, to universe power, you know, full-blown electronic level expression, okay? Because remember, the force organizers are getting things going, and then the power beings are really working on purposing stuff, getting it to power, purposed energy, gravita. Okay, yeah, now this is that last little statement. The physical energy circuits administered by the power centers of Eversa require a little over 968 million years to complete the encirclement. Notice how, you wanted to say encirclement, but it says encirclement of the super universe. The fact that you said encirclement is how you were initially interpreting that sentence. You're thinking, okay, they've got these circuits and apparently stuff putzes along in some circuit, and it takes 968 million years to chug around, you know, back to the generator. Okay? Okay, but notice why they're saying that. Encirclement. Okay? And remember what we're talking about. We're talking about a power distribution grid. Okay? We're talking about a grid that they're laying out. You have the central node of Eversa, okay, with the supreme power centers that are on Eversa, feeding a grid out to the universe of local universes. Okay, and this. Remember, we've really gotten this straightened out. You have these 10 major sectors, these 10 pi wedges, and the record platter of those 10 pi wedges that's going around in a circle, encirclement, okay? That grid is locked on that whirl, okay? It strikes steps with the whirl, okay? I don't think there's any way other way to interpret it. I think what they're doing here is they're giving us a very important bit of information. How long does it take the world to go around once? Because that's something that there's no way we could ever figure out. If we're going to actually sort out the dynamics of the Milky Way galaxy, we can, you know, over time, we could slowly piece together all the gravity, you know, Keplerian motion stuff. But we wouldn't know the starting point. We wouldn't know the foundation. So I think this is what they're doing. They're revealing that it takes 968 million years for the world to go around once. The grid goes around with it, you know, in a circle. Okay. And then there's all the submotions and whatnot that we talked about within the major sectors. Okay. How does this compare? You know, the scientists have tried to figure out how long they think it will take the sun to go around the Milky Way. And they've got a guesstimate. Of course, there's all kinds of assumptions plus estimation in play, but their guesstimate is 200 million. Okay, see, it's the ballpark. Okay, all right. So what they're saying is now the foundation which you need to have revealed to you is 968 million, and then you sort out the details from there. You need to figure out how actually big the Milky Way is because you're way off, and you got to figure out all these submotions and whatnot. You got all kinds of work to do. Okay, but they've given you the foundation. Yeah. And there's an interesting thing that this immediately suggests. You know, if this is the correct interpretation of this statement, that that's how long it takes the world to go around, how long did it take Michael to do his seven bestowals? Remember, they usually just talk about it generally. They say it was about 1 billion years. Yeah, but they also say it was about 150 million between them. Well, take 150 million times the six gaps between the seven. What do you get? 900 million. Okay, 900 million, I say roughly 1 billion. You don't suppose that that's what... Have you ever wondered, why did he spread it out over 1 billion years? Maybe he spread it out over 968 million years. Maybe part of acquiring that measure of supreme type deity through those seven bestowals requires him, his experience, to actually go once around the circle. I can't say for sure, but it's suggestive. It's
lines up pretty good.
Maybe why. Once around the super universe, and he has acquired a whole relationship.
Yeah. But if he promised to go back to every single place, he's not going to get back here for 1 billion.
That's where it breaks down.
No. He promised to come back here because remember he has to finish this, you know, the bestowal mission, which he couldn't because he jumped ahead of the magisterial sun. But anyway, so that's just a fun little speculation you could throw in there. That might be what was going on with that stretching it out over that whole span of time. You know, so then you could do fun speculations like, okay, remember they said you major the fifth. Why is it fifth? Because remember we're in the fifth major sector. Okay. And we're on basically the outside of the circle relative to center of all things. So which major sector is directly on the inside? If five is diametrically on the outside, what's diametrically on the inside? Ten, right?
Yeah.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. See? Four in between, I say. Okay. So so when our major sector was around where 10 is right now, you could speculate. You suppose one of the particular bestowals he is lined up with that. Maybe he could only do what he could do when he was in that relationship to the center of all things, maybe. You see, there could be all kinds of interesting things going on here with your relationship to the bigger picture, with those seven bestowals, if that's the correlation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just it's a really fun thing to think that that might be what's going on. Okay. So yeah. So that's the 968 million there, Steve. I think that's what it's telling us. It's okay.
There's no gifted at dropping numbers like that.
Yeah. 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 And you notice how it's just, you know, it's kind of shrouded a little bit, yeah. You know, but the more you think about it, it's like, well, wait a minute. That must be the rural. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Evolving energy has substance. It has weight, although weight is always relative, depending on revolutionary velocity, mass, and anti-gravity. Mass in matter tends to retard velocity in energy, and the anywhere present velocity of energy represents the initial endowment of velocity minus retardation by mass encountered in transit, plus the regulatory function of the living energy controllers of the super universe and the physical influence of nearby highly heated or heavily charged bodies.
I warned you about this paragraph, didn't
Jeez.
I?
Yes,
you did. Okay.
Okay. Like a story problem.
Okay. We're not gonna fully dissect it. Okay. But just pull a couple little things that the starting points that they want you to get. To carry too far is meant for if you want to try to really start putting together new physics. So we're not gonna go that far. But just notice how they set it up. Let me help you a little bit here. Okay, so here they brought, remember how I told you they want to use the word weight in an elevated way, in a higher way. And, you know, this precise gravity response or reaction idea that precise, you know, that you've got something that's, you know, very definitively localized so that this whole gravity thing is going to have a real precision to it. You've got a little particle, a little thing that you can point to, okay? And it has this oomph, you know? And at the very least, it has momentum, even if it doesn't have mass, like we talked about a little bit. Like a photon has momentum, push on something, yeah, you know, it slams into it, okay? But it doesn't have mass. You know, and it has that because of this localized character. See, and that, so they're bringing that in, depending on revolutionary velocity, you know, the simplest thing, you've got to have something wrapped back on itself. You got to have some motion that's wrapped back on itself. Okay. It might go into a more full-fledged expression, which is what we call mass. If you get a very sort of omnidirectional wrap back on itself, very billiard ball-like thing that we call mass. You know, a photon is not that complete, and so, but it has this revolutionary velocity. It just doesn't have mass yet. You build up to that. And then there's anti-gravity, too, anti-gravity that is in that. So that, not to really dissect that too much, but just they're just trying to give you a little sense of what's going on with the little things that we're thinking about. Okay, and this whole bit about mass in matter tends to retard velocity and energy. Okay, the simple thing that a lot of people have some vague recognition of is when we think about light. Okay, that bulb up on the ceiling is giving off light. It's coming through the air, passing through the lens of my glasses and going into my eye. Okay, when we study the optics of light, we, you know, very early on noticed that there was this thing called the index of refraction. That there was this quantity that came up in studying light and optics that gives you a sense of how thick the thing that the light is passing through is. We have this notion of the velocity of light in a vacuum, quote unquote. In other words, the velocity that light demonstrates to us, you know, that it manifests, we measure, when basically it's not having to deal with any matter between point A and point B. Okay? So, but if, and it goes at a, you know, a certain speed, the quote unquote speed of light is that speed of light in a vacuum. But the light to go from that bulb to me, it goes a little bit slower than that to get through the air because, you know, there's air molecules. And it goes even slower as it passes through the lens of my glasses. The speed of light depends upon the transparent medium that it's going through, and the thicker the, you know, the denser the medium, the slower the light passes through that. See, notice how that's kind of the basic picture they're invoking here. You know, there's this velocity of the energy, but it's having to come into relationship with mass, be it the air, mass of the air molecules or the mass of the molecules in the lens of my glasses. Okay? The light gets through. And so, but it's not really going in what you kind of a picture, apparently a real beeline path. You just kind of think about this in sort of a simple individuality viewpoint sort of a way. It's like, well, how could I imagine this photon going slower, taking longer to get from point A to point B because there's molecules or atoms in, you know, in between point A and point B? Well, it's kind of doing a square dance to get from point A to point B. It's doing a do-si-do. That's one simple way you can kind of visualize it, you know, that instead of just going in a straight line, it's kind of doing the do-si-do, okay? So it takes a little longer to go from point A to point B, okay? Now, why is that kind of a fun little analogy? Notice what they, remember, right what they brought up at the beginning, the revolutionary velocity. Begin to understand that fundamentally, to make these little things, these particles, these little things with weight, you've got to have something wrapped back on itself. So this photon is trying to go on a beeline, but it has to come into relationship with little circular, see, little revolutionary motion phenomena. And see, in between the lines, they're telling you everything is a motion, and motions come into relationship. And what's trying to be a straight line motion has to come into relationship with a revolutionary motion. And so, you know, it's not a bad little analogy to begin to try to understand that, is thinking of it having to do the do-si-do with each of those little revolutionary phenomena.
Like a boat tacking through the water.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Those revolutionary objects have their own little gravitational forces affecting.
Well, I mean, that, you know, you have gravity in the sense that we think of, you know, once you have mass. But then, of course, we also have the notion that, you know, the photon's path gets curved as it goes past the sun. And okay, see, again, just not to try to create a new physics here, you know, in the air when I'm waving my hands, but just begin to see, if you start to think about it like that, it's not so odd to have the photon bend as it goes around the sun. I mean, if the sun is a mass, it's some sort of a wrapped back on itself, you know, rotational motion, okay? The photon has to take that into account. It has to kind of rotate a little bit as it goes by it. It has to be like that rotation as it goes by. So it rotates a little bit. Its path gets bent, you know, until it gets far enough away, and then it merrily goes on in a straight line again. The motions, are relating or combining, associated. You have associative motions there, okay?
Like they're paying a little debt.
Yeah. Okay. That's you know, they're trying to you know, they're giving a little teaser for what, you know, they start to build up more in later papers about the real physics. And then the one other little thing to notice along that line is notice how they say this. And the anywhere present velocity of energy represents the initial endowment of velocity, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, modified by various things. Forget, let's not worry about all the modifications. But just look at the starting point. The starting point is not zero. Okay? The starting point is the force charge of space, which is a motion. It's a unit scalar motion. That's the quote-unquote velocity of light in a vacuum. That's the foundational velocity. You know, the initial marker dots on the force charge of space. Okay? And you start with that. You start with unit motion, not zero. And then you get effective slowing down from the speed of light in a vacuum, quote unquote. You know, from the velocity, you know, the apparent velocity because of the motion of the force charge. Okay, that's the fundamental problem with understanding relativity right now, special relativity, the paradoxes of relativity and stuff. It's all because you're looking at it backwards. You're trying to understand it starting at zero and going up to some magic speed limit, and why can't you go past? No, you start at unity and go down to zero. Okay. You start with something that's like God, one. Start with unity, and you go down to zero. Okay. There's a God, so you don't start at zero and then go up to some magic speed limit that some magic matter imposes upon, you know, on it. Okay. Okay, it's a logical universe. Starts with God, starts with one. Okay, so that's sort of the basic philosophy that's in there. And then you can start to think about the details and of some hints they're giving about physics, specifics beyond that.
This digs right in directly with the modifications that now that are imposed in worlds way, way out there, and mm-hmm. how much observational error that imparts right. by the time we see that.
Right, you notice them. Plus the regulatory function of the living energy controlling our systems, all these things, see? Yeah. And you have to take that into account to get all the details. But both things and beings modify the basic force-matter relationship.
The universal plan for the maintenance of equilibrium between matter and energy necessitates the everlasting making and unmaking of the lesser material units. The universe power directors have the ability to condense and detain, or to expand and liberate, varying quantities of energy.
The universe is mind-made and personality managed. Everything has to be managed. Matter doesn't manage itself.
Given a sufficient duration of retarding influence, gravity would eventually convert all energy into matter, were it not for two factors. First, because of the anti-gravity influences of the energy controllers, and second, because organized matter tends to disintegrate under certain conditions found in very hot stars and under certain peculiar conditions in space near highly energized cold bodies of condensed matter.
And we kind of talked about, you know, stars are unraveling things down in the core, and of course, collisions of dark atoms of space, you know, whatnot, you know. Things can get disrupted, you know, or they can be unraveled by just imposing some anti-gravity influence by one of these beings. Okay?
There's no way for gravity to win that fight.
Right. Because gravity tops off with the Isle of Paradise, which is an absolute fact, and those power beings have trans-absolute nature in them. They can do what's above absolutes. Anyone remember? Co-infinite. They can bring the co-infinite to bear on the absolute, and the absolute will lose to some degree.
Okay. Say that, and it's true.
Yeah. So they can, you know, negate some of the centering influence of the aisle, because it's only an absolute centering influence. They can toss in a little bit of trans-absolute decentering influence. Yeah.
When mass becomes over-aggregated and threatens to unbalance energy, to deplete the physical power circuits, the physical controllers intervene unless gravity's own further tendency to over-materialize energy is defeated by the occurrence of a collision among the dead giants of space, thus in an instant completely dissipating the cumulative collections of gravity. In these collisional episodes, enormous masses of matter are suddenly converted into the rarest form of energy, and the struggle for universal equilibrium is begun anew. Eventually, the larger physical systems become stabilized, become physically settled, and are swung into the balanced and established circuits of the super universes. Subsequent to this event, no more collisions or other devastating catastrophes will occur in such established systems.
And so, and to stress that, because that comes up a lot. I mean, just remember that more and more things are being brought under control by the master physical controllers, okay? And, you know, just the random stuff that matter wants to do and it's left to itself, you know, happens less and less until it happens not at all, okay? You know, this is very much in play when you're talking about an inhabited world and its star, okay? They may let uninhabited things, you know, do whatever, but they're clamping down, okay? You know, and especially when the inhabited world is where a creator son bestowed himself, okay? There's plenty of power beings in reserve that can be called up to handle vicissitudes, okay? You don't have to worry about this world, you know, being torn apart by an asteroid, you know, collision or something like that. Okay, so, you know, in the middle there, make sure no one misinterprets, because we don't use the word in common parlance like this very much. When they say rarest form of energy, you know, they don't mean my precious. They don't mean rarest like that, okay? You know, the opposite of dense, okay? That use, like a rarefied atmosphere, you know, that use of the word, okay, rare. So what is the least dense form of energy?
Water.
No, what's the first form of energy?
Free automatons.
All right. That's the first, you know, you go from force to energy, okay? That's the rarest, okay? In other words, you know, like we said, I mean, you basically have these automatons just locked in a crystal. I mean, they're being crushed so hard they can't really form any higher structures. It's just like an automatonic crystal locked in this death grip, okay, of all this gravity. You know, you break that and, you know, the automatons just go spewing and you're back to square one again. You got nothing but free automatons and they got to slowly start all over again. Okay, building up to 100 and, you know, et cetera.
Threatens to unbalance energy to deplete the physical power circuit. Yeah. If it's locked in a crystal, right, there's depletion.
Right. And you'll see, they're going to mention that. There's this balance between, you know, basically more free energy. That's a tough one to say. Liberated energy, not free energy in the video YouTube video sense. And at this balance between, you know, this rarest form, you know, basically automatons on the loose and stuff that's really locked up in matter. They have to keep this in balance. You can't let it go too far either direction. So it takes all kinds of management to that equilibrium.
During the times of plus energy, there are power disturbances and heat fluctuations accompanied by electrical manifestations. During times of minus energy, there are increased tendencies for matter to aggregate, condense, and to get out of control in the more delicately balanced circuits, with resultant tidal or collisional adjustments which quickly restore the balance between circulating energy and more literally stabilized matter. To forecast and otherwise to understand such likely behavior of the blazing suns in the dark islands of space is one of the tasks of the celestial star observers.
You can see how there's difficulty on the two ends of the spectrum. You don't want it to get too far either way because it's going to impact habitability of instability of domains. So they got to manage it. They got to keep it away from the endpoints. And you know, do they have to actually send out secondary dissociators, for instance, to really kind of, you know, unravel something? Well, maybe not, you know, if they determine, no, you don't, it's going to take care of itself. Those two things are going to collide here, you know, in a couple hundred million years or, you know, a few billion years or tens of billions of years or whatever, and, you know, it'll fix the problem.
So they just forecast it.
Yeah. But they do have beings that, you know, are dedicated to just, it's like, no, we're going to need to step in here. This needs some, you know, active unraveling. You can't let, you know, any sort of quote unquote natural processes play out.
This is more minus than you want.
Yeah. So, very complex system. And obviously, you see that whole sense of the physical domain, you know, is a long ways away from where scientists are. You know, to think of it as the physical domain being mind made and personality managed. But it is in a lot of ways. So, in order to do physics, you've got to figure out if you can basically, well, this system right here, I can neglect the influence of mind, you know, including mind old beings. You know, there's no invisible hands manipulating this. I can assume that validly. So I can figure out the physics. And you know, but if you know there's personality or mindful, you know, manipulation, then, you know, you can't do it. Yeah, right. You have to, in order to do the physics that we can do, you have to figure out if you can neglect, you know, the impact of entities and beings upon that system. Can you neglect the impact of beings on the master universe? And if you're trying to think about the master universe as a whole, can you ignore God? No, of course. God is going to be the dominant influence on the whole. Okay? You're going to have to find a little region. Okay? So how valid is our cosmology that tries to explain the whole? And the first assumption is God equals zero. Okay? It's completely invalid. It has no validity whatsoever. Okay? And we used to know that. We used to know that cosmology was a metaphysical effort. Now we think it's a science. Okay? This is ridiculous. Okay? You can't ignore God when you're trying to think about the whole. You're going to have to humbly observe the whole, you know, and just take it for what it is. That's what the revelators do. They can't explain the respiration. They just observe it. Know its details. I have the slightest idea of the causality of it. You can't. Yeah.
Humility is not in the mind, which is science.
All right.
We are able to recognize most of the laws governing universe equilibrium and to predict much pertaining to universe stability. Practically, our forecasts are reliable, but we are always confronted by certain forces which are not wholly amenable to the laws of energy control and matter behavior known to us. The predictability of all physical phenomena become increasingly difficult as we proceed outward in the universes from paradise. As we pass beyond the borders of the personal administration of the paradise rulers, we are confronted with increasing inability to reckon in accordance with the standards established and the experience acquired in connection with observations having exclusively to do with the physical phenomenon of the nearby astronomic systems. Even in the realms of the seven super universes, we are living in the midst of force actions and energy reactions which pervade all our domains and extend in unified equilibrium on through all regions of outer space.
Don't ever forget, they have to not only contend with all the details of the super universe level, but it's not like we're not influenced by the gravity of all that mass out in, you know, especially the first outer space level. Okay, that stuff's tugging on us. So they have to deal with all that, you know, and they look out there, it's like, God, this stuff is just like unmanaged. It's going this way and everything. You know, I'm going to have to try, you know, a trillion years from now, all that stuff is going to be clumped over there. It's going to totally mess up my, you know, they've got to deal with this. Okay, the Virgo cluster is going to just totally, you know, I mean, they've got to deal with all that. Okay. Yeah. It's a good thing they're what? Very intelligent. Yeah, even the ones that aren't personal, because they've got to really be thinking on their feet constantly. It's just a constant, you know, that's why they have so many phrandalangs, you know, countless number. Because you've got, I mean, you need very minute, precise measurement going on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
They're the meters.
Right, they're the meters that are just spread, you know, everywhere. It's this blanket distribution of them. So that they can meter every point in the super universe level, try to keep track of all this. Okay.
The further out we go, the more certainly we encounter those variational and unpredictable phenomena which are so unerringly characteristic of the unfathomable presence performances of the absolutes and the experiential deities. And these phenomena must be indicative of some universal overcontrol of all things.
Overcontrol. Cosmic overcontrol. Is that, which is that? Is that capacity, potential, or upholder? Remember the functions coming from the Trinity? You have totality attitudes. Who can name the next one? Can you remember what the next one in the sequence? Coordinate action and cosmic over control. Okay? All right. You know, don't ever forget about the mother, you know, the upholder, cosmic over control. But see, prior to that, okay, the presence performances of the absolutes and the experiential deities. In other words, you know, here you're basically thinking experiential deities, you have God the Supreme, God the Ultimate. And of course, you also have God the Absolute, but like we've talked about, we don't really experience that as so much as something that comes down, but something that wells up, it wraps around the other side and seems to be coming up from the bottom, that imposition of God the Absolute, as the presence performances of the Absolutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, but really, you know, it's God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, God the Absolute, in the various ways that they engage us. That God the Supreme is the total finite engagement. God the Ultimate is the transcendent engagement. And God the Absolute is so transcendent that it's sort of supplying the foundation, it appears, rather than even more transcendent than God the Ultimate. Okay? So you have all of these holistic experiential deity engagements, grips, you know, on the picture, you know, and the whole has ideas about what the whole should be up to, okay? And sometimes the parts have to strike step with those orchestrations of the whole. Yeah, so they're talking about. And so, you know, so if you look really closely, you start noticing that, you know, you calculate all the part-to-part sort of stuff, and there's a little bit left that doesn't come from part-to-part interactions. It's the whole touching the parts. Okay.
This last sentence of this paragraph is something that I think a modern-day scientist could never put in a paper. All these phenomena must be indicative of some universal overcontrol of all things.
They used to put sentences like that in a paper.
Yeah.
It used to be science. It used to have God as its nucleus. It's not science if it doesn't have God as its nucleus. It's just humanism.
Ready? Mm-hmm. The super universe of Orvantan is apparently now running down. The outer universes seem to be winding up for unparalleled future activities. The central Havona universe is eternally stabilized. Gravity and absence of heat, cold, organize and hold matter together. Heat and anti-gravity disrupt matter and dissipate energy. The living power directors and force organizers are the secret of the special control and intelligent direction of the endless metamorphoses of universe making, unmaking, and remaking. Nebulae may disperse, suns burn out, systems vanish, and planets perish, but the universes do not run down.
Okay, so a little bit of watchmaker God poetry going on there, but notice it ends up, universes do not run down, but it started out, the super universe of Orvantan is, apparently, now running down. Reminding you, remember we were just talking about it, it's a universe of motion. And in some of the very sort of gross aspects, it may seem to be not in motion as much. You know, you look out in the outer space levels, you know, and there's galaxies going every which direction. They're churning, they're slamming together, they're flinging stuff all over, you know. It's like just this totally, you know, motion everywhere sort of picture. It's apparently in a lot of motion. You know, if you were to look to Havona, if you could see Havona, you know, especially over the length of our life, it would seem to be static, frozen, you know. There's no sign of any, you know, stuff flying around, you know. Okay. In other words, it's not like it's gone from motion to not. Like you're saying, universes do not run down. It's a universe of motion. Our God is a living God. Everything stays in motion. It's just that it becomes more and more internalized, instead of being external. Okay. To think of all of that frothy chaos of the outer space levels eventually will get all bottled up. Like they were saying here, subsequent to this event, no more collisions or other devastating catastrophes will occur in such established systems. Okay? All of that frothy gets all bottled up into this majestic stability. It's still there. It's just that it's all inside. There's an internal dynamic, you know, to those worlds of Avona. There's incredible motion bottled up within them, all brought into all of that everywhereness, that unity likeness, is brought into complete relationship with individuation. Unity and individuality are in this perfect associativity of this dynamic little bottle, you know? Yep.
So the Milky Way galaxy near the center, where there's more things closer together,
mm-hmm.
we would, with the current science, would think, well, everything's close together, things are going to be smashing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Where in actuality, there's far less chance of accidents there than there is out away from the
center. You might definitely speculate that things, you know, or would be under, you know, and it's like, well, they would probably have to be if they're all that much closer. Yeah. You got to keep closer tabs on them because you don't want things to just go chaotic there. You're going to rip UVersa headquarters apart. Yeah. So things are going to have to be quite managed in that close. You're not going to have some violent, uncontrolled, supermassive black hole just doing whatever it wants, okay, like we currently think of the center of the Milky Way, okay? Even if there were black holes, okay? right. You know, that...
Well-behaved if they were.
You know, right now, they think that the most out-of-control place in the Milky Way galaxy is the center. No, the most in-control place is there. Just like we see so much, when you finally kind of get the picture in front of you, oh, it's 180 degrees turned around. Yeah, almost everything that we know, quote unquote, is totally perverted, turned all the way around 180 degrees. In order to get yourself right with the cosmos, you've got to grab a hold of the picture and figure out how to rotate it around. But of course, well, if I rotate it, you're going to have to rotate everything around. You've got to reform your whole picture, get everything flipped around.
What's the word for one unturning?
Yeah, one unturning.
I used to say that was the formula for straightening things up. Just put it at 180, and you've got the formula.
Yeah, and the challenge of that is that there's an occasional sense of that you get from your spiritual consciousness, a little bit of insight, but there's a tendency for humans to do it in rebellious fashion, you know, to ignore most things and just try to go at one thing and just force it around in defiance of everything else. See, that's the definition of rebellion. I mean, it's not like Lucifer wanted to make things chaotic. He wanted to make things more ordered, okay? But he wanted to do it in a circumscribed fiat fashion. You can't do that. You have to take the whole picture into account. You know, and your insight and your foresight may recognize that eventually this needs to turn around 180 degrees, but you can't do it out of, you know, form with everything else. All your actions need to conform with the cosmos, the universal harmony, and that requires time. You have to let things, you know. And so even when they're managing the physical universe like this, they have to take things into, you know, the time component into account. You know, they know they want to eventually make that like that. Okay? But they, it's like, well, but I can't do it right now. I've got to do it over the next trillion years. And it's not going to be a straight line just rotating it. I'm going to have to rotate a little bit and then translate it. And it's some long, complicated process so that you keep everything in balance. That's the amazing thing. See, the neighboring planet did. You know, why they give us that picture. You know, there came a point when they recognized, wow, this is out of whack. Oh, well, this is out of whack. Oh, wait a minute. Everything's out of whack. Okay, stop everything. They just brought their whole civilization to a stop and systematically went through their entire system and reformed the whole thing.
They had the formula.
Okay. But change without growth is potential evil. See? That's the thing. You can't just grab a hold. I'm going to change this because this is not right. Yeah.
But it's coupled but, to the cosmos.
And most likely, if you just torque that around, you're going to make things worse than they were. Okay.
I just thought it was quite an interesting revelation for a kid to have, was that things were backwards. Not there was no intention to fix it. It was just an aha. Things are backwards.
And the revelation is here to try to help us as best as it can about how to begin this so wise process of turning things around as we can begin, as we're beginning to see they need to be, but to do it over time and to do it in a holistic way.
And also not to be sucked into the way it is, not to be desensitized to the norm so that you can be balanced.
Yeah. It's kind of the inevitabilities, you know, sort of coming into play there.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, that gets us through the tougher slog. Okay, and like I mentioned, now it goes into a slightly different mode, and we're going to get a little bit more about how the beings fit into this complex, managed physical system that we've been slowly building up, and kind of even bringing in a couple little microscopic details here of physics at the end. And so there's a lot left to go, and we've got a lot of fun stuff to tour through. Let's take a moment here.